where Bridgeport comes for news and talk. The Lisa Wexler Show, now on Southern Connecticut's news and information leader, WICC 600.
Standing by is Rich Cohen, who probably has a lot to say about this conversation. I think he's been listening in. But first, we're going to go to our own morning host, Melissa Sheketoff, who wanted to weigh in. The topic is the fact that a very big school district in Illinois has decided, the school board has decided that for the next school year, they are going to grade based on your race. They are instructing teachers, directing them to take into account race and ethnicity in grading. And they are also telling them that for those populations that are black or of color, that they should not be penalized if they don't show up to school or don't hand in assignments. And that's what they're doing. And they're also decided that from now on, an F, as in Frank, will be 19% or less. So you get a 20, get one out of five, and you pass. Melissa, what say you on this?
I know you have another guest, so I will not keep you, but this conversation has infuriated me. You're doing an amazing job, and I think everyone who's called in has made a lot of sense. When I was a kid, a lot of my listeners know, my younger brother is autistic, and while he is high-functioning now at 30 years old, when he was in elementary and middle school, he struggled a lot in school, obviously, had, you know, a lot of special needs and had the paraprofessionals and everything like that. In the 90s, when here in Connecticut, we did the No Child Left Behind, it was the worst thing to happen to Matthew because, you know, this was a kid who was taking Western Civ, for example, but can't make change out of $20. Mm-hmm. And yet he's passing, and my brother got, you know, we had to literally, thankfully my parents did well enough to, like, put him in with therapists and put him in social groups after school. But, like, my parents had to invest in my brother getting the things he needed to be able to go and get his associates, essentially, later on in life. But a lot of the kids that he grew up with, and were still in touch with their parents, they're still living at home, they're still bagging groceries, and they never got that opportunity because they were pushed through the education system, even here in Connecticut. And again, I can only speak from a special needs sister standpoint, but the No Child Left Behind idea, like, that was a failure for my brother's class back in the 90s. So this conversation has reminded me a lot of, like, how infuriated we were with the idea of, like, just push them through. It's they're fine. Like, it's great. Put them in geometry. And it's like, geometry? My brother doesn't even know how to make change out of a $20 bill.
So basically, it's this glossing over with so-called good intentions, this thing that it's sort of like make-believe reality. Let's make believe that they know this material. Let's make believe they're really passing. Let's make them feel good about themselves. And in the end, when you do that, you're not helping anybody.
Correct. Like, in the moment, sure, my brother walked across the stage in fifth grade with the rest of his class, and sure, he felt good in that moment, but, you know, by the time he got to high school, you know, it's no real secret. My brother's the only one of the five of us who did not stay local. My brother was so mortified by the way he was handled here in Connecticut that he moved out of state.
Wow.
So he never came back home. Like, he lives in Florida permanently. He's happy down there, and he has no intention ever moving back here. But a lot of it is because of the way he was handled through the education system.
Isn't that something, Melissa? Wow.
Yeah. So, and a lot of families don't have that opportunity to invest in things that, like, my family, like I said, we're very grateful that my parents were able to afford to give Matthew services outside of school. But most families can't do that.
No, of course not. And if you're going to turn a blind eye to people's real issues, then it gives the school district an excuse not to treat those kids, not to give them the services that they need. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You're exactly right.
It's make-believe. It's make-believe world. Yeah.
It is make-believe.
Yeah.
Yes, in the worst way.
In the worst way. Thanks, Melissa. That's Melissa Sheketoff, our wonderful morning host for Morning with Melissa. Don't forget, she's on every single day, which is just unbelievable, from 5 a.m. to 10 a.m. here on WICC. We're going to turn now to one of my favorite authors, and I don't say that lightly. Rich Cohen, to me, is always one of the most compelling, entertaining, interesting authors, whether he's writing a long-form magazine article or he's writing a book, a biography. His latest is a biography of his own father, The Adventures of Herbie Cohen, the World's Greatest Negotiator. Rich Cohen lives in Richfield, right here in Fairfield County. Rich, I hope you're feeling well this morning. I was hoping to meet you in person. I heard you're a little under the weather.
Yeah, well, I have my son comes home from college and brings a luggage and some kind of crazy cold. So
okay.
But it's okay. I'm getting better. I'm on the mend, and I would like to come and meet you in person someday.
Well, right, I love this book. Rich, I'm telling you the truth. I picked it up, and I read it cover to cover. I didn't miss a beat. I have so many flag pages here. First of all, Rich Cohen, your dad and my father have a bit in common, but they're not the same personality. But they both grew up in the same generation, and I think they were born the same year. Was your dad born in 29?
No, 32.
32. Okay, my father's 29. Yeah. My mother's 34. That's right. And your father was Bensonhurst, and my dad was Williamsburg.
Right.
Okay? But Brooklyn Jews of a certain generation, a certain hustle, right? Let's call it what it was, a certain kind of hustle, and also a certain sense that the world was essentially an optimistic, happy place, that America was a land of opportunity. And not just a cliche, but an actual truth.
Well, it's funny because somebody just asked me, why do you think so many people from that neighborhood, because I know my father's neighborhood very well, were so successful. So my father grew up with Larry King, Sandy Koufax is from that neighborhood, Elliot Gould. There's a huge list of people. And I said, I think because it was the American dream. They believed everything was optimistic, and they believed they could do it, and believing they could do it, they did it.
That's right.
You know, and I was just listening to your conversation. Of course, I think what's happening in Chicago is happening in Oak Park and River Forest. I grew
yes.
up in Chicago.
Yes.
That, I'll remind you, that is where Ernest Hemingway is from.
Really?
He never went to college, so he learned to write at those public schools. It just shows you what those schools were like. You know, that's where he learned to write. And my father, when I didn't, there was a period of time in high school where I just wasn't doing very well. And he took me aside and he said, I want you to tell me what grades you think you're getting. And I told him I was way overly optimistic because I didn't want to get in trouble. And he wrote it down. I had all A's and B's. And I got my report card back and it was like B's, C's, and D's. And his whole point was, you got to be realistic with yourself or you're going to get nowhere. You got to start by being realistic about where you are and where you're going. And this is now like the teachers themselves aren't realistic about the kids. And I would feel like if I was one of those parents, I would be so offended, you know, that you think that my kid can't get through normal school that they'll need for the rest of their life. It's crazy. My friends are talking about it all morning.
Right? Isn't it a crazy thing? And I think it's demoralizing to teachers who want to raise the bar and insist that their children learn something in the classroom.
Yeah, it's like the school saying we give up.
We give up.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We give up. And I think it's terrible. I think it's terrible. So, and you know what? They're doing it. And you know what's even worse, Rich? We're chatting with Rich Cohen. They're doing it in the name of diversity, equity, and inclusion. So it's such a perverted, subversive, nasty way of looking at a laudable goal of trying to include more people in the American dream, and instead saying, because of your race, we don't think you can do as well. So we're
right.
not even going to hold
right.
you to
that's
those
why
standards.
I'd be offended if I was, that's why I'd be so offended if I was a parent there. You know, and it's like, again, talking about that generation that came out of, you know, Brooklyn, there's neighborhoods like that in Chicago where I grew up. And their attitude was just give us the tools.
Yeah.
And we can compete with anybody.
That's right.
And the tools were the basic, solid education. You know, Ernest Hemingway coming out of there, learning how to write the stories he wrote in those public schools.
Exactly.
So, it's a little depressing, and, you know, hopefully something will happen, it'll change.
I hope so. I mean, it's definitely getting national conversation for sure. It might be a warning sign to other school districts that were thinking of doing the same thing. It's not going to go over very well.
I think there's going to be a big blowback from parents because they want their kid to be able to succeed on their own. You know?
They want to. If I'm a black parent, and I want to know why 77% of the kids in my neighborhood aren't passing the SAT. Don't pass them. Tell me why they're failing.
Yeah, I mean, just it's just a crazy thing because you change in the wrong end. You got to just prepare people and give them a fair shot by teaching them, and otherwise, it is like you're just quitting on them. And believe me, if you were going to go in and hire an architect to design your house and you found out that they got a 19 on math, you would not be very happy with that.
Exactly. And if you want to go to the moon and they say, oops, I'm sorry, I was passed in astronomy. You mean it didn't hit the moon? I missed it by an inch? Too bad. Sorry.
Yeah.
There goes the spacecraft. Just sort of missed its mark. So your book, The Adventures of Herbie Cohen, is a book about a man of tremendous grit and just tremendous humor and tremendous personality. First of all, tell me something. How is your dad now? Is he in good health? Talk to me about your father. Tell me about Herbie.
He is in good health. I mean, he's 89 years old. He's had problems. When I was a kid, I was worried about his health. He'd always say, "Don't worry about my health. I can't die. Nothing can kill me."
I know.
And every time he had some kind of health emergency, I would go, "Do you still think nothing can kill you?" He'd go, "Hey, if that didn't kill me, nothing can kill me. That proves it." So somehow, amazingly, he's still alive. He's 89 years old. He's still very sharp. So, you know, he has some problems, but basically he's good.
Is he living in Boca? Where is he living?
He's living back in Brooklyn. He returned.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah. I forgot. That's right.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's a very unusual story. Now, your mom passed away. I know I'm skipping around, but your mom passed away.
Yeah.
So and it seems like in the book, after your mom passed away, he decided he would go back to Brooklyn. But is he alone in Brooklyn, or does he have a woman or a
companion? He lives in the same building as my brother.
Okay. Okay.
And he's got grandkids coming in and out, and he has a girlfriend.
Okay, so good. He has people. It's very unhealthy to
and
live alone.
He tells me he's a very good catch at his age because he can drive at night.
Yes.
Which makes him incredibly unusual in that age, in that demographic.
And he can walk and see all together, which I think makes him a good catch. So your dad, Herbie, by the way, I met Larry King a few times, actually, and he was very complimentary. I had him on my radio show many years ago when I was first doing the show, and he came on the air, and he was very complimentary. He's like, "Oh, Lisa, you have so much talent, blah, blah, blah," which was very nice to hear from him on the air. And he gave us a blurb for our book, Secrets of a Jewish Mother. But your mother thought he was an empty suit. Your mother didn't like him at all.
Well, my mother knew him when he was still Larry Zeiger. They were kids in Brooklyn. And Larry was always up to stuff. So he would take everybody. He had a bit of a gambling problem, which was later brought under control.
Oh, yeah.
It got him in big trouble.
Big trouble.
He was actually arrested. Yeah. So one of my mother's first meetings with him is they took their money to buy theater tickets, and he gambled away that money. And without telling anybody, he bought tickets to a much cheaper show. And she was pissed. And I think what she really didn't like is my father, who's this, you know, this guy who lives by this philosophy. My father's philosophy is the key to life is to care, but not that much.
Yeah, I saw that.
And to approach life as if it were a game. And he also always said, and this goes back to, he said, never abandon a mature design to gratify a momentary passion. But when he got around Larry, all that went out the window, and he was like a 12-year-old kid. They met when they were 9 years old. So I think that's what drove my mother nuts. When Larry and my father were together, it was like there was no one else in the world, and they were 12. And I know this from experience. Their favorite thing to do is to go to baseball games, get out on the field before the game, and talk to baseball players. And I was ditched on the field in Baltimore by my dad and Larry because they saw a player that they liked a lot when they were kids, and they ran off. And a pro baseball player came up to me and said, "Excuse me, did your father just ditch you because he wants to talk to a celebrity?" I said, "Yeah, basically, that's exactly what happened."
We're talking with Rich Cohn. Rich, can you stay with us? We got to go to some commercials. We'll be right back.
Sure.
We're chatting with Rich Cohn, The Adventures of Herbie Cohn. We're going to get into what makes a great negotiator when we come right back.
Join the conversation. Give Lisa a call. 203-333-9422. It's the Lisa Wexler Show. Only on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Welcome back. We're chatting with Rich Cohn, the author of The Adventures of Herbie Cohn, his own dad, the world's greatest negotiator. All right, Rich, I need you to set the stage. Let's talk a little bit about your parents and your grandparents, just a little bit to give a framework of where your dad was coming from in terms of how his life and career and how he decided he never wanted to go to another Friday night dinner. Just give us a little bit.
Well, my father was from Bensonhurst, which was like a lot of the parents were immigrants. My father's parents were from Poland. Yiddish was like sort of their first language. And they were not educated past about age 12. And my mother was from Midwood, Brooklyn, Flatbush. And her parents, also Jewish, but they were like German Jews. And they had gone to college. My grandfather was a lawyer. My grandmother had gone to NYU and got a degree in English, which was unusual at that time. So my dad used to say it was frowned upon when they got married. It was considered a mixed marriage. you know.
Same in my family. Same exactly in my family. My mother's side was much more educated. My great-grandmother actually went to a college, and my father's side was right off the boat from Minsk and from Lithuania. Same.
Yeah, exactly. I think my grandparents thought of my mother, you're like, we got away from this and you're pulling this back into this immigrant thing. And my father thought that his in-laws looked down on his parents who he idolized, and he was offended, you know, by the way they treated his father. So my grandfather, Ben, who actually couldn't get a job, I wrote a book about this too called Sweet and Low. He couldn't get a job as a lawyer during the Depression. He ended up working in a diner. That's where he met my grandmother. Her family owned the diner. And I won't go into all the details, but the diner did very well during the Second World War. It was by the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And then after the war ended, there was no customers. He didn't know what he was going to do, and he took an old teabagging machine and converted it into the first sugar packing machine. He invented the sugar packet.
Amazing.
He also invented the soy sauce packet.
Incredible.
And he turned his diner, which had been the Cumberland Diner, because it was on Cumberland Street, into the Cumberland Packing Company. And if you look on the back of a Sweet and Low packet or Sugar in the Raw, also their product, that's still what it says. He invented Sweet and Low about 15 years later. And it's funny, because when he invented Sweet and Low, that was my mother and father were just dating. And he invented it because he wanted to put sugar in his, you know, iced tea, but there was no artificial sugar. There were just these little tiny dots that were cyclamate pills, and he liked to see the sugar cascade down. So he invented artificial sugar, and when my father would go pick up my mother, there'd be like 12 cups of coffee waiting for him, each with a slightly different variation of the formula that became Sweet and Low. And he would make my father test them all and say which tasted more like sugar.
Interesting.
And years later, this is always cracking me up, when they said that saccharin, which is a main ingredient in Sweet and Low, causes cancer in lab animals. My father's first reaction was, I knew it. I knew he was trying to kill me.
So, okay. So your dad didn't have the greatest relationship with his in-laws, but your father was a firecracker. Your mother married somebody special. So tell us about your dad.
My dad is just like sort of a street kid from Brooklyn, always loved to talk to people. He really lived that life is like a game. He'd get into and out of trouble. Larry would tell this famous story on the radio called the Mapo story, which he said was my father's first negotiation. You can Google it and hear Larry telling it in the 70s. It's a funny as hell story about how my father and Larry raised money by saying a kid who'd left for half a year had actually died and raised money for his funeral wreath. And my dad talked the principal out of suspending them by doing what my father's trick or whatever is radical empathy, which is he looked at it from the principal's point of view and said, look, we're going to get expelled from school, but you are never going to work again in New York City. So the whole thing was sort of swept under the rug. But he ultimately went into the military during the Korean War. He came back. He met my mom at NYU, and they started having kids basically right away like you did. And then my mother moved right from the house of her parents to the house of her husband. And my father took law school classes at night, and he worked at Allstate Insurance, and he was a claims adjuster, which was like a lot of quick negotiations one after another, and he was so good at it, they started having him train other people, and ultimately, they gave him control of the New York area, then the entire region, and they had him training the whole company how to negotiate, and then Sears owned Allstate and hired him and brought him to Chicago, which where I was born. He went out one weekend and just bought a house. He picked this town called Libertyville, Illinois. And my mother said, you don't know anything about this town. And he goes, well, I know there's Jews there, and we won't be the only Jews. And she said, how do you know that? He goes, oh, there's a Chinese restaurant. There's got to be Jews. Turned out to be the only restaurant in America with a Chinese restaurant and no Jews.
And no Jews.
Until we got there.
Yeah.
And he worked at Sears, and Sears was like Amazon then, in that it had all these affiliated companies. It was the biggest store in the world. And they started using him to train all these people and do their negotiations. And at some point he thought, I'm just going to quit Sears, go out on my own, and start hiring myself to companies. And he ultimately worked for like probably dozens and dozens of Fortune 500 companies, training their people how to negotiate, and then actually, you know, representing them in deals. He worked for the NFL Players Association, then he settled police strikes. And then he started doing classes for the FBI. And at the FBI, he helped set up their terrorist hostage program and their behavioral sciences unit, which is his whole thing, which is you got to, you know, that you got to know who you're dealing with if you want to negotiate. And his thing is always said, if you want to understand the price, you got to understand the player.
Mm.
So they would build these almost like novelistic reports on who they were dealing with, who these people were.
Interesting.
Because he said that the most important thing in a negotiation, time and information, and that equals power. And his big thing is, and he, this is a great thing, which is you always have power, and there, you always have something to do. It was a great way to grow up because no matter what would happen, he'd always say, there's always another move to make. You can always decide how to act. And the thing was, he said, power is based on perception. If you think you got it, you got it, even if you don't got it.
Yeah, like there were stories about how he would never stay online because, you know, lines were basically for suckers. I sort of grew up that way, too, by the way, Rich. And you know, there's an attitude. You sort of inhabit an attitude. You walk in, you tell a story about how he walked past a security guard because he said something that would only be known to security guard lingo. And so the security guard guy assumed that he knew what he was doing, too, and he walked right past him.
Yeah, well, this was at the Democratic National Convention full of security. He basically pretended to be the security guy's boss.
Right.
And asked him questions about shift time and all these stuff, security questions. And he said, you're doing a great job. I'm going to put it in the report.
Uh-huh.
And the guy was beaming, and my dad just walked right past him.
Your father is an interesting guy. He's a little bit of a con man. He's a little bit of a finagler. He is. He's a little bit of a schmoozer. He's all of that. He's really a character. He's a character right out of Damon Runyon. I loved him so much.
Yeah, he had fun doing all this stuff. And like the Democratic National Convention, there's no reason for him to get in. The thing that would always cause him to do that is somebody would say to him, "You'll never get in." And that was like a red flag to a bull.
So
he said to Larry, I'll meet you tonight on the floor of the convention. Larry said, I don't have a pass for you. There's a ton of security. You'll never get in. So then he had to get in.
Yeah. He didn't like to take no for an answer. Yeah. Yeah.
He didn't like being told he couldn't get in somewhere.
Yeah.
He took it as a personal challenge. So he'd find there's always some other way in, you know, and there's always some other thing to do. It was great. So ultimately, like, his huge thing he did is he worked on the strategic arms reduction talks representing the United States during the Reagan and Bush administration, which is like about, in that world, as big as you can get. And he wrote the book, You Can Negotiate Anything, which sold like 2 million copies. But he would do that. He'd be like, you know, in Geneva or whatever, negotiating ballistic missiles with the Russians. And then he'd come home, and the first thing he wanted to do was, you know, go out with me to buy a used car because I needed a car because he thought it was really fun and wanted to teach me how to negotiate. And he approached everything, no matter big, small, it didn't matter, was always the same, you know.
His big message was,
people were scared of negotiation. It intimidated them. They thought it was like haggling. And he always said, you're negotiating all the time. You just don't realize it. And all I'm going to do is teach you how to do intentionally what you're doing unconsciously, and thereby you're going to take some control of your life. And if you approach it like a game, you'll actually have fun. You'll live longer, and you'll be more successful.
Is his book, You Can Negotiate Anything, still in print?
It still sells like 30,000 copies a year. It's
incredible.
Outrageous.
It's outrageous. We're chatting with Rich Cohn, whose book about his father, The Adventures of Herbie Cohn, is so wonderful. It's so endearing. I loved it so much. I loved that your father, wherever he goes, makes it like Bensonhurst. My dad, wherever he goes, does the same thing. Wherever he goes is another bagel place. There's always a group of guys hanging around my dad, even now in Boca, playing bridge. They just love him, and they love your father, too. I want to meet your dad one day. That's what I want to do.
I'll bring him in.
Okay. Rich Cohn, thanks so much. The Adventures of Herbie Cohn. We'll be right back with the next hour live of the Lisa Wexler Show here on WICC. Stay tuned.